It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A massive manhunt in France after a brazen prison escape. Two French police officers dead. The BBC has more, so don't be thrown by the British accent.
Huge manhunt is underway tonight for an escaped prisoner and his accomplices after two French prison officers were killed and three others injured when a heavily armed gang ambushed their prison van. The brazen attack took place this morning in Incarville, near the city of Rouen in Normandy. Inside the van was Mohamed Amra, known as the Fly, who was being driven through a toll booth on the way to prison when the van was attacked.
The Fly. In Francais, la mouche. Tragic, daring, and as both the BBC and I already said, brazen. France mourns. The gendarmerie is not used to such carnage. One reason is, as reported in the New York Times, quote, at a time when France is trying to project an image of law and order ahead of the Olympic Games, the images of violence on the main highway from Paris to Normandy were a blow. If it was only, say, the Paris Biennial, not a big deal, these murders of policemen, but the Olympics, yeah, gotta pay attention to that. Should have clipped the wings of La Mouche a bit more carefully, knowing that the Olympics were coming to town. But I wondered about this image that the French were supposedly wondering about, the image of their country as dangerous. They project that to the world. Certainly, high-profile prison breaks, murderous prison breaks are not good for PR. But what about the actual baseline numbers of homicides? Is France dangerous? Should an American worry about going to France? Well, according to official records, in 2023, France had 1,110 murders. Now, France is a country of 70 million, so the U.S. is five times as populous. So five times the number of murders that France had, and I'll do the math for you if you went to a high school and not a lycée, I'll help you out. It would be 5,000 murders. That would be if U.S. and France were similarly murderous. But the U.S. does not have 5,000 murders. Indeed not. The U.S. experiences yearly approximately 20,000 murders. Now, I say approximately because it goes up and down. It was a 13% decline last year, which is good, of course. But mostly I say approximately because even the FBI acknowledges that it can't count all the murders. In 2022, there were 15,047 homicide incidents, 16,485 offenses, according to the FBI's NIBRS data. But as they acknowledge, that covers only 76% of the total population. Why so many murders in the U.S., even in a country that lacks la mouche? Well, a British observer, not with the BBC, but with who? Yes, indeed. With the WHO, Roger Daltrey, of all people, was on the Bill Maher show, and didn't take much for Roger Daltrey to get it right.
The difference is, of course, that we haven't got guns.
Right.
So we look at you and we go, whoa.
Right.
Life is good.
A lot of people get stabbed, though.
Now, did you hear Bill, who I very much like, did you hear Bill say, well, you have knife crime? And they do have knife crime. It's a problem that dominates headlines. The BBC is always talking about it. They should. People are scared of scary things. You want to know how many knife homicides there were last year? In 22-23, they combined figures for years. There were 244 knife homicides in England and Wales. Don't worry, I looked up the other two parts of Britain, and Scotland had 23 knife homicides, and Northern Ireland, 8. So if you adjust it by population, we find that an American is about 15 times as likely to die from murder by gun as a Brit is to murder by knife. Because if you include all gun deaths, suicide being the biggest category, a Brit is 35 times less likely than an American to die from knife versus gunshot. Roger Daltrey saying, I hope I die before I get old. In America, for generations, you had to hope that you didn't. Now, the U.S. had, this was 2021, the most murderous year, but not so much higher in terms of statistics. It had, in 2021, almost 50,000 people die from a gunshot. almost 50,000 people. So it amuses me, then immediately saddens me when any other advanced country frets about their reputation when it comes to crime or local stories anywhere but the U.S. in the developed world where they will tell you that crime or homicide is out of control. And I have to emphasize, in terms of U.S. gun crimes, this really, really has almost nothing to do with AR-15s and semi-automatic weapons. Almost nothing. Less than 1%. Less than 1% of rifles of any kind. It has almost nothing to do with school shootings. If you put a graph of all the deaths, unless you had a gigantic page, you wouldn't even be able to see the dot that represented the school shooting deaths on that graph. And it has almost nothing to do with mass shootings, as they're covered by the press. We very much worry, and we're right to worry, about the over 20,000 or so civilians killed in Gaza, numbers that have since been revised down. The numbers of identified women and children have been revised down a bit. And I know all the differences. I know the vast difference in the size of the population. I know the differences in who's doing the killing. One is the state, one is the other people, other citizens in the population. But that is a literal war, which has garnered the world and America's attention, really arrested our attention. But we're talking about the death toll in a different country, a country thousands of miles away, not about the death toll in this country. And in this country, we actually have direct authority to do something about our armed militants. We can easily, we don't want to, but it's quite easy as a matter of procedure to pass laws that would affect the much greater killing in our actual country. We could do something about the laws of arms procurement. In this country, a country with twice the number of bodies as that other country thousands of miles away. Let us compare America to France. There are 50 times as many bodies. And this even includes the death toll in the wake of La Mouche and all the national soul searching that his murder spree has engendered. On the show today, an economist walks into a brothel. It's such a good, grabbing title. And the person who grabbed you in that brothel was Alison Schrager. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's a Bloomberg columnist. I just love talking to her about the economy, so I decided to do so for the entire rest of the show. A real pleasure, much insight. We'll talk about retirement age, marijuana, and yes, sex work, brothels. Alison Schrager up next. Let's talk the economy or specific companies in the economy or why we buy what we buy. You're not hooked yet. Brothels. We might talk about brothels because I'm joined by Alison Schrager, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a City Journal contributing editor. She is a columnist for Bloomberg, and she is the author of An Economist Walks Into a Brothel and also the co-founder of Lifecycle Finance Partners, which I was joking with Alison before we started. Like, what is that? A direct Peloton contributor? And it's not, is it?
No, it's risk advisory. We're life cyclists. That's our intellectual orientation.
Uh-huh. Do you think that there is a play to combine the two where you could be a risk advisory firm but also do some aerobics on a bicycle?
Yeah, because my academic background's in retirement economics, like how to, you know, save, invest for retirement. But now, like, a big push in, like, elder stuff is, like, quality of life. Mm-hmm. And, like, how to be healthy in your retirement so you can still work and contribute. So, I mean, exercise is a part of the strategy, I'm told. I'm not an expert in this at all, but I've read some books, some popular books, like three of them. And I'm told
that's some. That's good. When you hit two, you say if I read one more, it will count as some. So I'm going to read some books.
Yeah, I've read a few books. I've read Outlive, and apparently it's important to do physical exercise if you want a high quality of life and still work in retirement. So it's relevant for me. So yeah, I mean, if you're on the Peloton, particularly weight bearing exercise, which apparently is part of it too.
Well, they have the little 2-pounders that I think are more about the appearance of weight bearing exercise. But you did say there's a big push into use that phrase, and that is a phrase they use at SoulCycle, which I've done a lot. All right, big push, last minute, everyone up on the bike, and then, you know, some Sia backing track drives us home.
I've done SoulCycle, but is it true they give you like life advice as you're on the bike?
They don't. This is the thing. I would sign up for a SoulCycle type service where the person who was running it wasn't, like, didn't memorize a whole bunch of good quotes, supposedly inspirational sayings that are also available at Walmart in wall hanging form. Like, this is my big problem with SoulCycle. It's, you know, a really fit instructor who also has a sideline as a guru. I can't take it.
Well, yeah, I mean, no offense to the SoulCycle instructor, but I mean, I'm sure they have a very full life and they're a very actualized person, but I'm not
sure. They're better, right. They're definitely happier and healthier and everything more than us, for sure.
But given my life choices, I'm not sure why this is someone I should take advice from.
Right, right. And if she came into, well, let's say you decided to do a private consultation and the SoulCycle instructor, he or she came in there. If you got a little off your... if you got a little unfocused and just started telling them about, I don't know, heart rate, she might, with a grain of salt, say, okay, could we stick to the numbers?
Yeah.
So while we're there, let's talk about your main, what Life Cycle was doing, and you love writing about pensions. Is it just the case that, let's stop, forget where Social Security starts paying us. We as Americans have to assume we're going to be working till, I don't know, 77.
Maybe. I actually just, I think, wrote this, that, like, I feel like we should embrace that as a good thing, because you don't have to, like, work like you're working now. Like, I tell my parents, who don't listen to me, but actually my father did, my mother doesn't, because they're in their 70s and I don't see them stopping working. I mean, they just, like, do the parts. I mean, they're self-employed, so this is somewhat easier. Just don't do the parts of your job you find aggravating. Just, like, fire the clients that annoy you. And just work less. And that way it'll be more
sustainable. So make less money, but make money.
Honestly, if you make like a third of the money you made while you were working in your 60s, like that will really transform your retirement financially and like living well. Because the other thing that I've learned from those three books is that it's important to have socialization and a sense of purpose. And work is good for that.
Work is, I mean, we've reoriented our society to essentially say work is that.
Yeah. But it is true. Like, even when we were like hunter-gatherers, I mean, that was your purpose, you know, hunting and gathering.
You said something interesting. So if you work less, I don't think people conceptualize it this way until they're thrown into it. It used to be the case you'd work for one company and you'd get a gold watch and you'd get a pension. But pensions, you didn't get a full salary. What's considered a good pension, like a good municipal worker's pension? 20 years in and they give you what would be a typical or very healthy percent of your annual salary?
Like 0.5%.
Right.
So you generally got like 70% of your working income, and that's plenty of money.
Yeah.
I mean, you spend a lot less money when you're retired, even if you want to take a lot of trips. Because it's just like being a working person requires a lot of expenses. There was this like, wonderful paper that came out when I was in grad school that is now like 20 years old. But I still love because it showed that old people or retired people spend a lot less money just because like when you're working, you're busy and you're raising kids. And so you'll just like grab a meal at a convenience store.
Yeah.
And there's a big markup on that. But when you're retired, you'll like seek out bargains and actually go grocery shopping. And this like was like a 20 right off the board, like 20, you'll spend like 20% less just because you have more time to comparison shop and like don't eat a lot of convenience food.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a large corpus, can I say corpus, of study about the high cost of being poor. Right. And well, do you believe that? I mean, I believe it.
Yeah.
I think it's really true.
Oh, yeah.
Like your car breaks down and someone rips you off. The underlying logic there is that time and money are in tension, and if you're poor, your bandwidth is taken up, and so you are forced into making not even choices, like you don't have choices and you have to spend a lot of money. That same thing, let's shift it up a couple of income deciles. It's still true, right? Mm-hmm. It's still true that your bandwidth is taken up by being a middle class or a lower upper class worker, mm-hmm. and you're not able to make the best decisions where you're saving money because time is money.
Yeah, or just like, yeah, I mean, you're a busy person. You put a premium on not having to like spend 4 hours going from grocery store to find the best deal on pasta. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, you have other things to do.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
I think that there is some sort of logic if we're trying to build the case that maybe you should work till you're older, or maybe you have to, but that's not so bad because you could fire the 30 of your clients that take up 2/3 of your time. Also, with all that extra time or somewhat extra time, you'll be able to make the dollar stretch further. I would also add to that, you're not going to be marketed to all the time. You have set into not ruts, but patterns of spending that probably work for you. Maybe you've acquired some capital, right? So you'll be owning rather than renting, which could help you in your retirement. So my point is that all of those things argue for the older worker and citizen being in a better financial position than is generally really believed.
Well, that's just true. Even without working, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, I'm defined benefit, defined contribution. Like, so the old school pension were defined benefit, defined contributions, like the 401k we have all now. Like, I'm agnostic. Like, I don't really think one's better than the other. It's just about how they're executed. Mm-hmm. But the thing is about the old school pensions is they were so expensive and the vesting rules were so arcane that, like, a lot of people, like, didn't have them. Or if they did have them, they didn't do that much for them. So actually, like, the 401ks, like, moving to that meant way more people have retirement benefits. Mm. So even if people do stop working in their 60s, they're still typically better off than retirees were a generation ago.
Interesting.
Like, they do have more money.
I thought it was always presented quite the opposite. Like, 401ks.
Yeah, it is.
Well, go ahead. So
that's fake news.
Give me the case for that. As I understand it, 401ks were seen as a lesser economic benefit than just working for, and we could name our Fortune 500 company, you get your pension or you work for the city and it's automatically in there and that's gold. And 401ks are a lesser version of that, which is more beneficial to the employer, but because it relies on the employee opting in, they don't do that as well. And when you compare the benefits of each, a pension was, of course, much better. So my two-part question is, am I describing what the general thinking is? And then if so, why is that wrong?
Well, it's true. Yeah, it's absolutely true. Like, if you are going to work for a big company and it's stable and they have a well-run pension and you're going to be there your whole career, that is so much better than a 401k. I mean, the big difference is who bears the risk. It's not necessarily even the financial value. It's just like bearing risk is expensive. It's difficult. So effectively, they're taking on all of your longevity risk, like how long you're going to live, because they're going to pay you as long as you and your spouse live. And they're taking on all the market risk. Mm-hmm. And also, they're very generous pensions. So they are great, but they didn't, not that many people had them, and they tended to go bankrupt a lot before ERISA because they were so expensive and companies didn't account for how risky the risk they were taking on their balance sheet. And a lot of people didn't have them. So if you were lucky enough to have that pension, you were definitely worse off in this 401k world. But the thing is, odds are you wouldn't have had that pension anyway. So the 401k is better than the nothing you would have had.
Yeah. But ERISA is a 1974 act, right? Employee mm-hmm. Retirement Income Security Act. So post ERISA, which is the era we grew up in, they got safer, or didn't they? Or did they go bankrupt a lot?
Well, once they forced companies to fund them properly and recognize the cost of them, they ditched them. So it's like ERISA really, like, people like are like, aha, this clause in ERISA ended pensions. It's like, no, it's the fact that ERISA forced companies to realize how expensive these things were. And then they're like, oh, never mind.
Yeah.
Also, you could argue, although this is my dissertation, which actually turned out to be incorrect empirically.
I love it. It's fantastic. Go ahead.
Was that, like, if you're going to change jobs more and have more variable income, it's bad to have old school pensions. It turned out, like, another, like, economic, like, myth that, like, everyone's really attached to is this idea that work has gotten more risky and wages have gotten more unstable and we're changing jobs all the time. And none of that is actually empirically true. In fact, wages have never been more stable and we stay in jobs too long. But if that weren't true, defined benefit plans would be bad.
What, when we say wages are stable, what does that mean in practical terms?
Well, it's actually an interesting, I think it's interesting, but it never, no one ever talks about it. And maybe because it's not interesting, so it's interesting to me. So for a lot of years, including when I was in graduate school, like everyone just sort of accepted that, you know, so think of your wage. This is how I'm a life cyclist. Think of your lifetime earnings like an asset, right? And you can look at how much they go up and down year to year. And just like, you know, a stock. And so we thought for a long time that they were moving around more year to year. So wages were more variable and it's just like having a more risky stock. So people were risk averse. You can't plan all these terrible things. And we based that all on this survey that everyone used because you need to, it's very complicated. You have to look at someone's wages over like decades to know how risky they are. And yeah, it's hard to get that data. And so we relied on these surveys that had problems. But then the age of big data came along and a bunch of economists got their hands working with the Social Security Administration on people's like entire wage history. And it's completely accurate because it's, you know, Social Security information, payroll
yes.
data.
Yes.
And it turned out we were completely wrong that wages had gotten more stable over time.
Wow.
And this is why me, my dissertation was wrong. And although everyone tells me that I shouldn't feel bad about that because like some people lost their the whole canon of their work got wiped out in that.
So is it not the case in general that, and this is the narrative, we used to have one job, you stay at that job, and now we're all free agents, we're all in the gig economy, we're all moving around, and we're much worse off because of it. So that's not the case.
No, in fact, people are staying, so we're looking at all this 10-year data. And so what used to be is people used to be like, you had a bunch of jobs, they didn't work out. A lot of jobs didn't even last a year. But eventually you kind of settled in, if you were a man, just a man, you settled into this like long-term employment relationship that might last a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. But there was very unstable before that. What's changed is one, women are now staying with jobs much longer because they would kind of be very marginally attached to the labor force. And people tend to like be in a job for like the like being in a job less than 2 years is a lot less common. So this like job hopping isn't really true. Mm-hmm. But people tend to like be more serial monogamous with their work, and they tend to like work for a company for like 5 to 7 years and then move on.
Hmm.
So it's hard to say, like, so people, this is another myth, like, oh, you know, jobs are so unstable compared to what, like, not really, but like kinda. It depends who you are, and it depends what you mean by stable.
Hmm. Is it, what about the education premium? I just thought about that because as long as we're exploding myths, this is one that's come under some scrutiny with colleges getting so much more expensive and also the benefit of college, I should say, beyond the signaling mechanism being called into question. Are we economically still in the place with a clear college premium? And what are the implications of that if it's true?
Yeah, I still think there's a clear college premium. Like, I think people should go to college still. A lot of people should, probably even more than are now, although no one is popular to say that, and it doesn't seem like colleges. I'm actually very optimistic about college now. I feel like there's been trouble brewing, and they have not like really been educating people well for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I feel like now it's just out in the open, so maybe things will get better. But I think there's still a lot of evidence, and it might be signaling that if you go to college, people get very upset, and I understand why, that if right out of college you have a job that doesn't require a college degree, and obviously after you spend all that money, that's, you know, not a good outcome. But it's also true that you're much more likely to eventually end up in a college job, and mm-hmm. you're gonna, whatever job you end up in, your wages and your promotion does go much, much faster if you're in college. And it
yeah.
could be that if you're a college educated person that you know, you're a better worker, you're more disciplined, you're more focused. But I think also, you know, you do learn some skills. Maybe they're social. You know, there's probably still some math. You read some stuff.
A few books.
There's a signaling. There's also a social stigma. I mean, that's probably unnecessary. But I guess, you know, college is still, like, I think there is a legitimate college premium.
We'll be back with more from Alison Schrager, where we get to the promised sex work and the marijuana. We'll answer just how important is college. We're back with Alison Traeger, and earlier in the interview, I mentioned that Alison wrote a book called An Economist Walks Into a Brothel. She's the titular economist. We start this interview by talking about college premiums and sex work.
Speaking of sex work, which you brought up the brothel.
You wrote the book. You brought it up is why I brought it up.
Well, I actually was surprised to learn that there's a college premium even in sex work.
Tell me.
Because initially, when I did the book, I went to the brothel and like interviewed all these women in legal brothels. But I also got this economist scraped data from like the Erotic Review, which is like Yelp for sex work. And he ended up with like a million observations on sex transactions going back from like 1999 to 2017. Like the entire, like, whole, since sex work went online, he had a record of like every transaction, or not every transaction, but a lot of transactions. And it is interesting that even when you control, like, there's different segments of the sex work market. You know, there's, you know, the streetwalkers and seems to be more desperate economic situations. And then you have the escorting. So even when you just look at the escorts, which is like the sort of higher tier of the business and tends to be women who are more self-employed and, you know, more control their economic destiny and maybe even doing sex work more casually.
Yeah.
That college educated sex workers do to earn more.
Do the escorts ever have an S corp?
You know, I think this is like, no one agrees with me on this, like my feelings about what should happen with sex work, because like sex workers are very into the decriminalize movement.
Yeah.
Which I think is just like the worst of all outcomes.
Oh,
because,
really?
Yeah, because if you make something easier, you get more of the good and the bad, and
right,
there are bad aspects.
Right. You know, we're seeing that, like, hey, sex workers, look at the marijuana trade in New York.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
and just to tell listeners, maybe you live in a state where the rollout, or okay, maybe you live in a state with illegal marijuana. Maybe you live in a state like I think Oklahoma is doing it. Maybe okay, but in New York,
are they?
Nah,
is anyone doing it okay?
I don't know. I interviewed a guy from Politico about how Oklahoma is doing it, and it's much more. It seems like the libertarians had much more of a control of it because the Republicans wanted to not be involved at all. Anyway, Oklahoma aside. In New York, it is, okay, we're going to make it legal, but with no rules deciding how it will be legal. Mm-hmm. And then we will have a couple rules, but they'll all be challenged in court. And some of them, by the way, will be facially unconstitutional, I have to say, as a non-constitutional law expert. So it is, there's marijuana shops on every corner. They probably are all illegal. They're not that safe. And I don't know who's making money on marijuana. But go ahead.
Well, apparently the legal shops we're subsidizing as taxpayers do. But yeah,
oh,
so
great.
I'm a libertarian-ish person, but obviously, like, I think some things need to be regulated, particularly things like marijuana or sex work, which can have bad externalities and subject to abuse.
Yeah.
And so I really feel like sex work, much like I actually feel betrayed by the whole legalization movement of marijuana, because I always kind of assumed I supported it because I assumed it would be regulated. At least as well as alcohol.
Yeah. Or at least as well as like catalytic converters in your car, you know, emissions. You have to go get that
anything.
Inspected. Yeah.
So
anything that is regulated, right?
Anything that's sold legally.
Yeah.
So I feel like sex work also, it's pretty icky personally, but like I accept it's going to happen no matter what. So it should be regulated and regulated well. Sex workers actually hate that, as you can imagine, because they would like, many of them would like to do their jobs without fear of prosecution, but they also would like to do it without fear of regulations and taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so would I, but, you know, that's not how it works.
You probably wouldn't like to do your job. Taxes, yes, but if you could free ride on everyone else's taxes, but we all probably do benefit from some regulations, even if we're podcasters or... columnist for Bloomberg. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Like, is it like I'm libertarian-ish, but like, you know, I'm not an anarchist.
Yeah. So wait, how did I get to the sex work?
Oh, so the college premium.
Yes, yes,
for
I did
sex
want
work.
To ask you about that.
Because it's interesting, because you would not expect there's a signaling mechanism there, right? Like, no, like your customer doesn't care if you went to college.
Right. There's signaling. There's also, you know, the classic, I'm just trying to work my way through college, which everyone says. So if everyone says it, you can tell that the person...
Well, some of these women are like 45.
Right.
So, I don't know. So, But so I think this is evidence. I mean, I haven't done a cohesive study on it, that there is a value in college. I mean, maybe it is that these women are better businesswomen. Maybe they have more discipline. Maybe they, you know, run their business better.
Yeah.
But it suggests to me that, you know, or maybe they're just smarter. But that there is like inherent human capital that was gained in college. The fact that this premium even exists in sex work, where I'm presuming customers don't care if their sex worker went to college or not.
Yeah, I do wonder, how do we separate the fact that there is some knowledge, some growth, some flourishing, some human capital, you know, you're spending however many years there increasing your skill set. So that's got to be worth something, you would hope, unless the skills you're learning are some ideology, like just the actual phrases of an ideology that doesn't apply to the real world. You know, and I'm not saying that with shade on any particular school of postmodernism. But how do we know that the college premium, and you and I still believe in going to college and would recommend most people go to college, and you and I still believe that there needs to be a huge reformation of what's taught in college. How will we possibly know that these businesses or the premium is showing up, not because of what is actually learned in college, but just because these businesses, especially after a couple years, the person, you know, allowing for the person who gets the first job that doesn't require a degree, but eventually settles into one, and the job market selecting for that, how do we know that they're selecting for what was learned in a college or how much growth was experienced in a college versus just hiring for the kind of person who would go to college, which in our society is tied up to all sorts of things, like a person who could sit relatively still in class for a while, a person who didn't develop debilitating addictions or maybe mental health problems, a person who sees the rules of society and wants to play with them. I have no idea how you'd figure out that. Do they want what college gives, or they just want the kind of person who, as our society is structured, would go to college versus not?
Well, I wonder if college really matters so much for the time you settle into a long-term employment relationship. Like, I almost feel like, certainly in like finance, that it would, like, if you didn't go to college yet you'd had like a couple good jobs in finance where you did well, it would almost be like a thing. It's like, wow, you know, you beat the system. I mean, I don't think anyone really care, unless you went to an Ivy League school and care about people who go to Ivy League schools. I don't think anyone really cares where you went to college or if you even went to college by the time you're like 30.
Yeah.
But like, the fact that you went to college was very important for the human capital you accumulated, not just in college, but in those first couple jobs in your 20s.
I think ideally, and I hate to say this, college should not be fun or should not be hedonistic fun. It should be a sort of intellectual fun, and it should not be a total grind where people are miserable. But if there were an effort to take most of the fun out of college, which is generally how colleges differentiate themselves, we'd all be better off. And if at the same time there were really useful guilds or internship programs where people are actually learning things that is the equivalent, they would look at their classmates, let's say their high school classmates who went to college, and not feel that those classmates are all having a good time, better time than they are, right? While they're grinding away at actual work, things would be, we'd be much better off. And I don't know how to get there, but I have looked at some societies that are there, and those seem to be better off in terms of understanding or incorporating college into the overall fabric of their societies.
I don't think we're that far off, because I mean, I'm told post-COVID kids refuse to read. Mm-hmm. There's the rampant grade inflation. But I think even before that, I think a lot of kids, I worked hard in college. I had fun, but I worked very hard. And I think a lot of kids still do. Like, if you're studying engineering at Columbia, like, you're probably still working pretty hard.
Yeah, right. The real schools, yes, we almost have to take the STEM fields out of it, because those are the only parts of the college that are growing and that are attractive and that clearly have a one-to-one relationship between what you learn and how much you earn and what your skills are.
I was shocked that, like, in all these interviews with the campus protesters, that they're all economics majors.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why are we shocked?
Well, that's what I mean, that's what I taught at Columbia. Like, they all seemed nice when I was there. It also just seems so career focused, or like, I guess I like to think economics in parts like logic and reasoning. And I mean, everyone says that they want to hide their faces so they can still work in a bank. So I guess the economics degree is conducive to that.
Yeah. Well, they actually, you know, at least they learned that bit of logic. Right.
That's no, but you expect them to say like, oh, you know, I'm a feminist studies or a Middle East studies major. But like, they're like, no, I'm studying economics and politics.
I've loved this conversation. It's been discursive. But I want to go back maybe to the beginning thing we talked about, which is your thesis that we're going to have to work longer and or we get to work longer and it's not that bad. And I love the insight that, you know, just working, plan on working a third less and firing your third worst clients or whatever the equivalent is. And then you'll be earning as much as you would if you had this pension. And we talked about why pensions themselves have been oversold. But a main, I guess, complaint or rebuttal to the it's okay if we work into our 70s argument is some of us can't work. Some of us have back-breaking jobs and it is classist or in some other ways immoral to suggest that these stevedores continue on as septuagenarians. And to that you say what, Allison?
Well, that's true, but I mean, I think it's sort of a weird argument that because some people physically can't work that everyone should not work. Like, most of us can. And, you know, we have a disability program or we can tweak Social Security that if you have a physically demanding job, you still can't do that, or, you know, or just in poor health. That, you know, you don't, you know, we could just, you know, find a way to boost their Social Security benefits and everyone else can work.
Are there a lot of people in this category? Is it more of a useful rhetorical tool?
I think it's more of a useful rhetorical tool. I mean, it's hard to measure. I mean, I guess, you know, we could, first of all, I mean, the number of people doing physically difficult jobs has definitely been falling over time.
Yeah, right, right. As this argument gets voiced more and more, so does another argument that no one seems to relate, or people don't seem to relate. Oh, we're all being replaced by robots. Well, maybe that's a good thing if you don't want backbreaking physical labor.
Or even like when I, you know, when you do like there's a building being built outside my window, and that's a physically very hard job. Like I watch these guys and I'm like, that's an like I can't, like, it's very difficult and looks dangerous to me all the time. But I'm also noticing everyone over 50, like, isn't doing those jobs. Mm-hmm. They're in charge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even within these jobs, you know, you do sort of tend to age out of the physical work. I mean, again, not everyone does that. Not everyone, you know, is going to end up on that path. But as I said, we do have disability programs or can sort of structure Social Security so everyone else works longer. And if you do have a physical reason why you can't keep working. And some people don't even have physically demanding jobs. They're just in poor health.
Yes.
That we can, you know, find ways to support them so they can leave the labor market.
How related is the official retirement age where people could get Social Security benefits? How important is that in changing our minds or defining what age everyone else will retire?
It's very important. Like, you can claim early retirement at 62. I think you can still retire at 65. If people our age are probably going to retire at 67 because it has been increased. I think now you maybe you retire now at like 66 or 65.2 or something. Mm-hmm. It's increasing to level off at 67. And you do see big spikes in retirement at those ages. People are very suggestible. I think mainly because no one really knows how to make these decisions on their own. So people retire once they can and once Social Security suggests they can. There's huge financial benefits to waiting till 70. I mean, Social Security, like, really, it's the only free lunch, I feel like, in retirement. Is if you wait to 70, there's huge financial benefits, but most people don't do that. They retire when they can.
Allison Schrager is a Bloomberg columnist, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the author of the Substack Known Unknowns, and as you could see, just a fascinating and compelling raconteur with a background in Scotland somehow. And Connecticut, the classic store Scotland combo. Allison, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Mupru, Jipru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.